The warning signs, reading from the book now, the warning signs, he says, are easily seen. Replacement of human and spiritual values with slogans and self-indulgence. Concentration of wealth into the hands of a few as poverty increases exponentially. Citizens who are politically disengaged and ignorant in a culture that becomes a parody of itself as it obsesses on its slogans and symbols but ceases to live out its ideals.
Yes, that's Spengler. Yeah. And he was spot on. And my hope, frankly, is that we can turn the tide, that we can change that.
Well, let's talk about that. Most of the corporations in the United States are bringing in less than $10 million a year. In fact, you started several corporations.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I'm a compulsive entrepreneur. I've started a bunch of companies in my life, built them up, sold them off. I've never gotten rich off any of them myself, but a couple of them have done very well since we sold them. And God bless them. You know, the people. But again, that's free enterprise. And it's becoming, frankly, increasingly difficult to do in America because these huge corporations have acquired the power to just squash like a bug little startup ventures.
And these corporations, you cite as one of the main reasons why a third of all Americans will get cancer in their lifetime.
Yes, which is part of the clash of values, that you have the corporate value, which says profit, period. And of course, before 1886, actually, most states required corporate charters to state that the first purpose of the corporations being incorporated was to serve the public good, and the second purpose was to manufacture matchbooks or whatever, you know. But now we after the charter mongering era of the 1890s, that has changed, and corporations have this singular value of profit, and now that they've seized the political discourse and the media, which controls much of the political discourse, we have these bizarre discussions about, you know, well, how many parts per million of arsenic should we have in order for it to be acceptable to industry? Well, what happened to how many parts per million should we have in order for it to be acceptable to human organisms?
And when the regulations get put in by the FDA or the EPA or whoever, at that point, then the pollution becomes legal, because then the corporations say we're within legal limits.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things that I found when I was researching the book was that again, first of all, let's just make the distinction. There are between 14 and 24 million corporations in America, depending on how you count it. The vast majority of them are good small businesses run by honest people who really care about what they're doing, have some passion for it, and are not using corporate personhood and not breaking the law.
And are involved in their communities.
That's absolutely right. And then there are a few thousand very, very large corporations and a few hundred really multinational corporations operating within the United States who are the major exploiters of corporate personhood. For all of those other millions of corporations, changing corporate personhood would change absolutely nothing, because they're not using the right of privacy to keep EPA inspectors out. They're not using the anti-discrimination laws to be able to overwhelm local communities from out of state. They're not using the First Amendment to be able to subvert the political process. So it wouldn't matter to them. But anyhow, what we're seeing here is this clash of values, that the human values, the need to stay alive, are not consistent with the need for profit, and profit has become the ascendant value in our culture. It's why the business press has taken over. It's why shows about business on radio and television, you know, it's reflecting the new emperors of the culture, the new lords of the feudal system,
the new religion. The loss of sovereignty has been made possible by the argument of corporate personhood and the corporate greed it represents through treaties like NAFTA and the WTO.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's taking corporate personhood national, or international, rather.
Yeah.
Corporations now under WTO and their dispute resolution panel system and NAFTA and Chapter 11 of NAFTA have the ability on a level playing field with governments to sue governments, to change governmental laws, to override the will of the people within national governments. So,
and to do it in secrecy.
Yes, yeah, and unelected people are appointed to the dispute resolution panels, quote, experts. Very often, they're not even affiliated with governments. The governments who are being sued do not have the right to represent themselves in most cases, and or in many cases. And it's this extraordinary process. I document it in the book, but there's many others that do. William Grider, you mentioned, is one of the best people to write on that topic if you really want to dig deep into it. And that's the bad news. The good news is that George Bush has taught us an extraordinary lesson in the last year or so, and that is that the United States can simply walk away from treaties. You know, a lot of us would have thought that was unthinkable, but, you know, he said, ABM treaty? Ha! Kyoto? No, I don't think so. You know, yeah. Well, yeah, we did sign that, but we're unsigning it. You know, it's a, and WTO, GATT, NAFTA, they are just treaties. They are not the international law of the land. They are treaties because they've been signed and ratified. So in a way, they are extraordinarily toxic and driving the destruction of the third world and driving the loss of the middle class in the Western world or in the developed world. And at the same time, I would suggest that they are still not as toxic as the concept of corporate personhood, which has allowed the corporations who are driving the WTO and that entire process to do what they're doing on an international scale, also on a national scale.
Well, let's talk about what real security is then. So if you're not suggesting a new unilateralism or to go along with the current Bush administration's unilateralism, what you're suggesting perhaps is what it says on page 263, relocalizing our economies.
Yes.
I would say starting out with food and clean water and clean air, probably the most important three things, and to get them within your bioregion. So a bioregionalist approach is one that makes it unnecessary or the ramifications of these treaties wouldn't affect local communities if they were bioregionalist in nature, getting what they need to survive within 50 miles, within the watershed, as it was with the native people.
And as it was with the early settlers. I mean, you know, it's for better or for worse. I mean, they took away the land of the Native Americans, but they did have a healthier interaction with their biosphere than we do.
With the exception of tea and the other stuff that came from overseas.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But I would say that it goes even beyond the biological obvious things to economics. I didn't write about this in the book. It was something that I had done the research on, and it ended up not making its way into the book. The publisher thought it would be a digression. But a lot of communities are creating their own currencies. In Vermont, we have what we call Green Mountain Dollars. And there are many stores in Montpelier, where I live, where I can shop using something other than United States currency. It's a currency that's only usable in Vermont. And what it does is it keeps all of our economic activity local. And this is happening in communities across the United States and Canada right now, and in communities in Europe as well.
How do you prevent counterfeiters?
You know, I really don't know. I suspect that could be a problem if the currency ever became really a substantial thing, you know. But if it ever became a substantial thing, then there may be enough money involved to print something that's hard to counterfeit. Right now, basically, it's a trust-based system. Everybody knows everybody. They know, you know, people pretty much know where you got those Green Mountain dollars. You know, it's
yeah, and it's going around. Ithaca Hour is another example
of
that. Yeah. What are some municipalities doing besides local currency to right the notion of corporate personhood?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. This is where the opportunity really lies. There are three or perhaps four levels of solution that I think are necessary for this situation. The first is to wake people up to the fact that the Supreme Court never said corporations are persons and should have human rights under the Bill of Rights. They never said that. They have never said that. They didn't say that in 1886. They haven't said it since then. No legislature has ever said that, and in fact, the vast majority of American presidents have warned against that explicitly, and you'll find those quotes in the book. So, number one, it's not true that corporations are persons, and it was never the intent of the founders. You know, so waking people up to the reality of that. Number two, And as a way of waking people up to that, a lot of communities are starting to pass resolutions. Point Arena, California, for example, passed a resolution. It's not a binding law. It's not something that they'll be sued by the corporations for or anything like that. There's kind of a no-risk thing. The city of San Francisco is debating one right now, or will be shortly. We've spoken with the supervisor who's going to introduce it. So a resolution basically saying, in our community, we don't believe that corporations should have personhood. So that's the first step. Then secondly, communities are starting to pass laws. There's 10 communities in the state of Pennsylvania. There's a couple in North Dakota now that have passed laws, ordinances, that say corporations can't own farms or corporations can't do specific things that if they were humans, they would, of course, have the right to do. And so they're denying corporate personhood. Well, these cases, of course, are being fought by the corporations, and they're going to end up before the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, though, that may be a good thing. This is kind of the third level of solution. The Supreme Court very often reverses itself. You know, I mean, when corporations were given personhood in 1886, in 1873, women came before the court and said, can we be persons? The court said, nope, don't think so. In 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, freed slaves came before the court and said, can we be persons? And the court said, nope, sorry. And then in 1954, in Brown v. Bush's Board of Education, they reversed the Plessy case and gave full human rights to African Americans. And in 1973, in Roe v. Wade, they reversed the Bradwell case of 1873 and gave privacy rights and other rights to women, you know, human rights to women. So if enough cases come before the court, after enough people have started talking about this, that the court kind of wakes up to it, because the court doesn't just do things in a vacuum. They do react to public opinion. Not always the way we would like, but they do react to public opinion in the broad scope. I mean, you know, if we're looking at a 100-year span, enough people are woken up, and then these cases start getting before the court will have an opportunity to reverse itself. Barring that, in the back of the book, first of all, we went through the laws of all 50 states, and we came up with ordinances that local communities can use to do this. We also have constitutional amendments for every state, and we also suggest that the Constitution of the United States, that the word natural should be inserted before the word person in the 14th Amendment.
And we will have a discussion regarding the chances of this being approved by a court dominated by Rehnquist and Scalia and Thomas after we get off the air.
Yeah.
But one last thing I want to ask you about, and we have just a little bit of time to discuss that, is despite all the bad news revealed by the book, you say America has come to represent the world's archetypal concept of freedom and egalitarianism.
Absolutely. When the protesters marched, many of them, to their death in Tiananmen Square, they carried a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché statue that they called the Goddess of Liberty. It was the Statue of Liberty. Even though we've imperfectly acted out democracy in our 200-and-some-odd years here, we have been the beacon for the world. As we go, the world goes. And that's why it's so important that we make these kinds of changes here, that we wake people up and that we take democracy back of the people, for the people, from the corporations.
We can find information about your book on the web.
Yeah, any bookstore carries it on the web. It's unequalprotection.com. Points right to the website.
It's a brilliant book. It's a heavyweight book, and I hope it happens in our lifetime. Continued success with your work.
Thank you, Paul.
Tom Hartman has been our guest. The book is Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights.